It's about 3 million people have epilepsy, and 250,000 of those are kids, people under 17. One data suggests that close to 150,000 people either get diagnosed with seizure disorder or epilepsy each day. It is quite a burden on the society, basically. It's a lot for people to change their lifestyle because of getting diagnosed with seizure or epilepsy disorders.
Let's get into the topic of epilepsy. This is something that spans the interests of technologists, neurologists, and patients alike. So what is the definition of epilepsy?
So International League Against Epilepsy is the organization that has defined epilepsy in 2005, and then they changed to incorporate a little bit more to it. Mm-hmm. So the current definition says is two unprovoked seizures. So unprovoked, they are not provoked by any external things like music, reading, light, sun, or things like that. Two unprovoked seizures in a span of 24 hours.
Okay. And it has to be 24 hours.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And then another seizure within 10 years gap from having those two unprovoked seizures. So, I mean, It's a long time. 10 yeah. years is a long time, but we have to consider if a kid is having a seizure, then for 10 years they did not have a seizure. So are they epilepsy free?
Yeah, is
correct. So okay. they have to be at least for 10 years, they should not have any seizure. And out of those 10 years, 5 years, they should stay drug free. Like basically,
yeah.
Yep, no anti-epileptic meds for 5 years of those 10 years time span.
Okay.
They should not be taking any seizure-controlling meds. So then you can say, yes, that person is seizure-free. So these are a few of the new things that were added by International League Against Epilepsy. It can be confusing for some people, but I guess it kind of makes sense having someone seizure-free for 10 years saying that, okay, now you are not epileptic anymore.
Right.
Kind of long stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. And epilepsy is such an ongoing field of study that we're learning so much about it. It's no wonder that terminologies change, definitions of who is epileptic and who is not, that is also changing as well. So it makes sense. Going into types of epilepsy, what are the different types that one could experience if they are epileptic?
So with the epilepsy, we have to think in terms of seizures, right? A patient can have seizure the seizures range basically from just sitting, doing nothing, all the way to convulsions. There is so much in between. You and I are talking and suddenly I'm steering. It could be maybe I'm thinking or maybe I'm seizing, right? But you never know that. So those are some of the things like in the earlier time, I wouldn't say earlier time, those were the things teachers would think, oh, he's a daydreamer.
Mm-hmm.
She's not paying attention in the class. Less that they knew that the baby, the kid sitting in a classroom was having absence seizures.
Mm-hmm. And right? Those are the staring spells.
Those are the staring spells.
Yeah, those don't know.
And then, of course, there are atonic seizures where the patient just falls, mm-hmm. like lose the muscle tone in the body and they fall. Then there are tonic myoclonic seizures. There are myoclonic jerks. And then there are partial seizure is a old term, focal seizures, like only one part of the body is twitching. And that can spread to the entire body. And patient can have full-on convulsions, which we call generalized tonic-clonic seizure. Again, that's an old term. But yes. So anywhere from staring, sitting quietly, to convulsing. So mm-hmm. seizure has this very wide range.
It's not just what you see in the movies where they fall down and they just start shaking all over. It is much more than that,
correct.
Like you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the involvement of the brain, like some people do feel that they have a seizure coming. That's called aura. That aura can be they are smelling something weird or they are seeing stars or they are hearing some sort of voices or sounds. So those people are aware that a seizure is coming, but sometimes the neural network is so rapidly engaging that before even body makes a sense, the patient is having convulsions. So the neurons in the body basically, so what exactly is a seizure, right? Like, so we have this 3-pound brain, right? Millions of neurons. they are electrically active. But every part, every neuron in the brain is doing its job. So they are active, they are excited, they are inhibitory. Suddenly there is an electric surge, like a storm in the brain. And that storm can happen in a tiny part of the brain, like maybe just a few neurons to a few hundred to thousand neurons. And that surge can stay in one place. That's what you call focal seizure. Now, if that network of neurons rapidly engage with the rest of the brain, it's going to spread.
To the entire brain.
Yes. Yeah. So just keep in mind, it's not your entire cortex that's seizing, because as an EEG tech, I'm putting electrodes on the head, right? I'm not saying the cortex is seizing. It's the brain that's seizing. So it could be one part of the brain. From there, the signal is going to the deeper areas of the brain. They are seizing. They are sending signal to other parts of the brain. So it starts as a focal seizure, but then it generalizes. It generalizes to full-on convulsions.
And you're saying, depending on where it is in your brain that it starts, really depends on the aura that this patient is feeling.
Yes. When we talk about temporal lobe seizures, we talk about aura. Temporal lobe is somehow more susceptible to seizures. Temporal lobe epilepsy, about 70% of the patients who get diagnosed with epilepsy, 70% of those are temporal lobe epilepsy patients.
Wow.
It's because somehow the way temporal lobe is connected to the limbic system, the hippocampus, thalamus, hypothalamus. So when those areas get active, the seizures will be seen on temporal lobe. Aura is one of the biggest sign of temporal lobe seizures or temporal lobe epilepsy.
Can you give us a list of examples of auras? So you had mentioned taste, smell. What are some other ones?
They feel like very bitter smell, foul taste in their mouth. Very bad smell, like rubber tires burning, hearing some sort of voices and sounds.
What about paranoia of being scared?
Yeah, so like the temporal lobe seizures, you have the mesial temporal lobe, you have the neocortex of the temporal lobe. So different parts will have different sensations, different feelings. People do get the epigastric sensation, like they feel they're doomed, the fear, the panic. They are scared.
Yes.
And sometimes they feel that, oh, I was in a situation like this before. So we call deja vu. So those are an automatism is another thing. Like they keep on repeating a movement. It's not a high volume movement, like picking on a dress or picking on a blanket. So those some repetitive movements, which are of low to moderate kind of a volume, not a huge one. Those are the temporal lobe. Why I'm saying is that people who have frontal lobe seizures or frontal lobe epilepsy, their movements are really big. They are like pedaling, bicycling, flailing their arms.
Well, that makes sense because of the motor cortex,
Of the motor cortex, yeah. Correct. So that's where your motor cortex lies, that get active. And you see all those larger muscles getting involved when the patient is having frontal lobe seizures.
You had mentioned an aura being feelings of dread. That actually reminds me of a patient I had in the EMU where she came in with delusions. She thought that her parents were out to get her whenever she was, that was her aura. And I remember hooking her up and thinking to myself, what kind of life would it be to just all of a sudden out of the blue have this feeling of doom and gloom and just know at any time that it could happen and you can be kind of unaware of what reality is. So as a healthcare provider, I think it's really important for us to really connect and empathize with patients that we're taking care of. It adds more value to your job as far as how you see it. Because if you feel like if you can get yourself in her shoes and think, I would hate to have that. I hope someone would help me if I was in that position. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes our job more rewarding to help them out. Don't you agree with that?
I agree with that. And as an EEG tech, like you were saying, when you go and hook up a patient and you read their history or you talk to them and get the history from them, right? how much you should know. I know it's totally an off topic. As an EEG tech, taking care of patient who has seizures or who are diagnosed with epilepsy, knowing what kind of symptoms they have, what are the clinical signs of their seizures, it gives you an idea. What are you looking for, right? And it not only that, it helps you to understand the patients too. That's how you connect with the patient, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just hooking up a patient, going your merry way, la 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 la, I'm done. Let's move on to the next patient, right?
Yeah.
So understanding the semiology, understanding the basic anatomy, where the seizures are coming from, and what are the functions of those. So you kind of appreciate the health, your health, other people's health more when you know if something goes haywire, that's what is going to happen, right?
Yeah.
So like going back to types of seizures, if the seizures are where the patients have positive signs, then there are seizures with negative signs. Like somebody who has garbled speech during a seizure versus stop talking completely.
Mm-hmm.
Having larger, massive movements like in convulsions versus atonic seizures where they just fall.
Yeah.
So there is, it's a plethora, right? It's not just one type. It's not a cookie cutter kind of a thing. So understanding different semiologies help the EEG tech too. And that keeps the job very interesting too.
Absolutely.
You'll never get bored.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is going to air before or after Mike, but I had Mike in here and we were talking about the different levels that a technologist goes through, from just putting electrodes on the scalp as an entry level job to you are telling the neurologist the abnormalities that are on the EEG. And so, like you said, understanding the anatomy, understanding the patient history, understanding even the medications that the patient is taking. These are things that help the technologist do a better job.
Yeah, and knowing why are we putting that particular electrode at that very place, that's what 1020 is bread and butter of this field, right?
Exactly, yeah. So let's discuss the global and national prevalence of epilepsy. How common actually is epilepsy?
Okay, so CDC and WHO, their numbers are pretty close when they talk about, let's talk in U.S., about 3 million people, little over 3 million people have epilepsy, living with epilepsy, and 250,000 of those are kids, people under 17.
Wow.
And one data suggests that close to 150,000 people either get diagnosed with seizure disorder or epilepsy each day. That is the data just from the United States. It is quite a burden on the society, basically. It's a lot for people change their lifestyle because of getting diagnosed with seizure or epilepsy disorders, right? So if you want to look at it, 1 in 10 people have either seizure disorder or epilepsy. CDC and WHO says they have epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if they're really following the ILA definition of epilepsy, but 1 in 10 people.
Yeah.
Imagine if you're getting a bus, capacity 60.
Yeah.
6 people in that bus
have epilepsy.
May have epilepsy.
You know, and I always say on this podcast that epilepsy is, we're learning more and more about it. And I'm wondering if the prevalence, the reason it's going up in numbers, is because people are understanding epilepsy more. That, you know, there are some cultures where they think it's a possession of some type of spiritual possession, and now maybe they're breaking out of that and thinking, you know, hey, this is actually an electrical abnormality in the brain.
Well, can we go 5,000 years back?
Yeah,
to answer that.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me, is there history behind that?
Okay, the history of epilepsy. So the oldest text that we could kind of read was the Babylon and Assyrian texts, those tablets that they found. So they found a sort of semi-damaged picture of a demon and they are talking that epilepsy is caused by demonic forces.
Would they say the word epilepsy, or was that not a word?
I'm not sure about it, but they're talking about epilepsy, and the demon that they're showing, it has horns. Its face is turned to one side and legs are turned to the other sides. And that is the epilepsy demon. Going a little bit forward, in Egyptian era, that was around 1700 BC, I would say that. So there they had this, there's a case study actually on the papyrus. They're writing it on the papyrus. There is a case study where this patient has a gaping hole, gaping wound in his head.
Is this a picture or this is a description?
It's a text. It's okay. A text. By touching that gaping wound, the patient will shudder. That means convulse. So I think from 2000 BC to 1700 BC, coming to that, at least Egyptians were thinking, huh, it's not a demon. It's something from the brain that is causing those convulsions.
So that might be a peek into the first scientific thought into...
Could be. It okay. could be. Going forward to Hippocrates' time, 500 BC, so that was the time when everybody was thinking that, so the term epilepsy, right? It's a Greek word, epilepsia. Epilepsy, seizure means to seize, to get possessed, like the possession of your body. And they kind of talk about it. It's because of the external forces. The demonic forces are the one that are possessing the body. That's why the people who undergo those convulsions or seizures, it's all about possession, right? So 500 BC, the text by Hippocrates, he wrote a book, he wrote a text on sacred diseases. He still called it a sacred disease, but it is not a godly disease or a demonic disease. He took that component out, and he did talk about that it is an organic disease. It's coming from the brain. And he even mentioned in a different text that to treat seizure, one should operate on the opposite side of the brain.
Did he really?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm not sure if they were doing surgeries.
Guy.
Yes.
He's a pretty smart guy.
He really was a smart guy. Yes. But his idea was never taken at that time. They did not sort of like, okay, shunt him away or something like that, but they never kind of accepted his idea that it is not a demonic disease. They were still considering it as that.
Going back to what you and I were kind of in awe from, for the patients who are listening in who might not understand or might not know what we laughed at real quick, let's talk about left and right side real quick for those who might not know.
Sure. So the signal from our body, when it travels to brain somewhere in the neck, in a very layman term, somewhere in the neck, the signal gets crisscrossed. In scientific term, we call it decussation. So decussation of the tracts, that means your left side, the signal from the left side of the body goes to the right side of the brain. So right side of the brain is controlling the left, and left side of the brain is controlling the right side of the body. So when we see someone having some sort of a jerking movement or twitching on the right side, we say that the seizure is originating from the left side.
Contralateral.
Yep. Yes. Yep. Yes. So it's a contralateral approach since there is a decussation of the tracts in the neck. And Hippocrates somehow knew that.
That's
It is cool, right?
Yeah, it is. It is really cool.
So people were considered basically crazy and lunatics. Those are the words used by physicians in 1600s, even some of the 1700s, that these people are possessed, and there was no concept of brain causing these symptoms.
Yeah.
But I guess gradually as we progressed, more and more people started to have understanding that these people do need medical attention. They need to stay in the hospital. They need to undergo certain therapies, some herbs or some sort of drugs or diet. Certain environment is good for them. It took, I would say, 1500 years, 2000 years before we even kind of decided that, okay, these people are not possessed by demons. But
even still, there's stigma still out there.
Correct. Some cultures, yes, it is. It still is. Yeah. But it's sad.
So, Navita, what actually causes epilepsy? What causes these seizures in patients who experience epilepsy?
Anything that changes the chemistry of the brain, the gross anatomy of the brain, maybe genetics. So these seizures can be caused by trauma to the brain. Somebody get hit hard, like a motor vehicle accident or otherwise also. Then some fevers can cause that. Some infections can cause seizures. And then, of course, there are genetic factors. And there are many seizure types. There are many epilepsy syndromes that we don't even know what the cause is. So we call those are the idiopathic reasons that we do not understand.
And is it true that everyone has the capability of having a seizure? It's just our threshold for people who don't experience seizures is high enough to keep these abnormalities at bay. Is that a true statement?
It sort is. We are born with 20,000 genes which can turn on at any time. So at any given time, you and I can have any disease or a disorder which our past generations, our family had never heard of. Yes. So like I said before, it's the excitability of the neurons, right? That you're brain cells and neurons, they are electrically active. So a surge of electrical storm in them can cause a seizure. So for any reason, it could be environmental reasons. It could be stress. It could be maybe you did not sleep well.
Alcohol,
yeah.
Drugs, yeah.
Yeah, withdrawal from the drugs. There are multiple reasons, yes. Anybody is susceptible to it. It may happen one time or it may become a routine for them. It just depends on the pathology of the brain at the given time.
So if a patient experiences seizures that are provoked 2 and 24 hours, that is not...
No.
Okay.
No, because then you are sort of creating a situation. It's not an organic thing, right? You are creating a situation. Like you would be amazed to know that people can have seizures by reading, music, bathing, brushing their teeth. Those are called the reflex seizures. No, that is not, that would not be classified as epilepsy.
Because it is provoked.
It's provoked, yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yep.
For patients who have epilepsy and seizures, how are they managing those? Through diets, through medications, through lifestyle changes?
I guess all of the above. So when a patient is newly diagnosed with seizure, they're not put on meds immediately. I mean, it's if it's a one episode, right? But the physicians want to keep a long, like close eye on them just to make sure they do not have another unprovoked seizure within given time. And yes, patients are put on regular regimen, regular medication. But there are instances where seizures are not controlled. So 1/3 of the population that we talked about, over 3 million people in US who have epilepsy, 1/3 of them have drug-resistant epilepsy. What that means is a combination of 3 drugs were not able to control their seizures. It's not just 1 or 2 medications. They were put on one medication, then on second, seizures are still not controlled, then they were put on the 3rd medication, and now seizures are still coming.
So what are the options for patients who the medications don't work for them?
Okay, for them, there is like another approach is ketogenic diet, where they decrease the carbs, the consumption of carbs, and increase the consumption of fats. This idea was proposed somewhere in 1920s. Wasn't very successful, but we really don't know the hardcore physiology behind it, but it seems with the high fat diet, there are ketones in the body, which increases the acidity of the blood and the brain, which helps with less seizure or no seizures. That's not like 100% solution to it.
I would imagine that's a good start before you get into things like, I'm imagining you're going to talk about surgeries and stuff.
Correct.
Like that.
So the next stage or next step, if you would want to say it, the implants in the brain.
Okay, what are those?
So there is a vagus nerve stimulator where they put an implant on the vagus nerve. And vagus nerve is a cranial nerve, right? That is one of the largest cranial nerve that leaves the cranium basically and goes all over the body. Again, we really don't know how stimulating the vagus nerve controls the seizures, but once the implant activity is detected and that implant, that it kind of gets, it sends a signal through vagus nerve to the different parts of the brain and can stop the seizure.
I'm in the industry, so I know that a vagus nerve is a coil that is wrapped around
the vagus, nerve. Yes, on the left side.
Okay.
It's always the left side because many functions vagus nerve has. One of it is stimulating the heart, the sympathetic as well as the parasympathetic, but vagus is a parasympathetic nerve, so it kind of slows the heart down. So the right vagus nerve goes to your atrium, basically. So sinoatrial node is controlled by the right. So left side, this coil is put on the vagus nerve, and it senses, and then it controls.
It senses electrical activity or an abnormality in the electrical activity?
Yes, it stimulates a vagus nerve, which in turn takes a signal to the brain and helps with the control of the seizures. Then we have deep brain stimulator, which goes deep into hippocampus. Like we talked about how temporal lobe epilepsy is 70% patients, right? The deep brain stimulator, again, it kind of senses the electrical activity around the brain and sends a signal to suppress the seizure. Mm. The third device is responsive neurostimulation.
And what is that?
So that is, it sits in the skull, in the bone of, and it records the electrical activity. That is the latest buzz, actually.
Oh, wow.
It is more, there's higher success with it. So it records the electrical activity. Once it sees that, okay, now it is a hyperexcitable neurons, and it sends the signal to stop it.
Wow.
So it is recording the signal, basically. It is recording the electrical activity.
And I'm assuming that a patient who has that has failed drugs.
Correct.
They've failed maybe a vagus nerve stimulator, and this is...
I would say it is a parallel. I don't know if it is. It
VNS?
Is a choice. Yeah, it is a choice of a stimulation for the patient, or the physicians choose it based on their symptoms and how many seizures they are having.
Yeah.
And when it is not controlled, even with these implants, then the next step is the surgery.
And what is that?
Even if we have like so much of brain, like every part of the brain is important, right?
Right.
It's not just sitting there and doing nothing.
Yeah, it's so, the whole. We only use 10% of our brain.
That's such a wrong idea. Yeah. At a given time, 10% of the neurons are excitatory.
That's a better way to say it.
Yes. The whole brain is functioning, basically. Yeah. Whole brain is active. That's the only organ that doesn't sleep, right?
Right.
Okay, so with the next step is the surgery. So where they have to find out where the epileptogenic zone is. That means the area, the part of the brain that is causing the seizure. It could be as tiny as 2 millimeters, or it could be a larger lesion on the brain. They have to find where it is first. So that's when the depth recording comes in. The grid recording, that is from the cortex. So they kind of open up the patient's skull, they put the electrodes, they record and see where the epileptogenic zone is. Now, we have to get that thing out, basically. The big component of it is brain mapping. You do not want to take out what is called eloquent cortex. That means the cortex, which is responsible for everyday life, which is keeping you alive. You don't want to take out the part which produces language, right, or sensation or muscle movements, things like that. Then comes the brain mapping. So they map the brain to make sure wherever that seizure-causing part was is not on the eloquent cortex.
And they do that through WADA
brain mapping. Yes, WADA. WADA, of course. WADA is mostly for language. they don't want to take out the part which produces language, mm-hmm. right?
And memory.
Because it's not just language, it is your memory too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let's say the epileptogenic zone is not on eloquent cortex, so they can remove that part to control seizures. Now, let's say if it is on eloquent cortex, they are not going to remove it. Then there are other ways, other processes that they use. There are the latest in epilepsy surgery is the laser surgery.
Okay. Tell me about that.
So what they do is they don't have to kind of take the flap out. They just make a tiny hole like a diameter of a pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And with a precise laser, with a 100% precision, the laser goes into the brain to target the epileptogenic zone.
Wow. That has to be life-changing for patients who go that route.
Yes, yes. That's that is the last resort because the surgery is going under the knife always has side effects, right? Yeah. And it's not an easy decision on part of patient, their family, as well as the physician.
Yeah. So I'm imagining there are going to be people who are searching YouTube, searching for podcasts, listening because they are just diagnosed with epilepsy or they are trying to manage their epilepsy or even have a family member. Let's talk about first aid for seizure. Whenever you see someone actually experience a seizure, what are some first aid techniques or maybe some myths that have come across where aren't true of how you should take care of a patient?
Like, you know, back growing up back in India, I remember people having seizures and they would say, oh, make him smell a shoe or a stinky socks, right? They will come out of it. No, it does. It's not.
That's not how it works.
That's not how it works. No.
No.
So if the biggest thing I would tell people is if you see someone seizing, let them seize. Don't try to stop them.
Don't try to hold them down.
Correct. Don't hold them down. And if they are lying supine or prone, put them on the side. Because all these muscles, either they are relaxed or they are hyperactive. The patient should not choke onto their saliva, or if they throw up mm-hmm. during the seizure or after seizure, just put them on their side and give the person some air, some room. Don't just crowd them.
Mm-hmm.
And, call 911.
Yeah.
I mean, don't just try to control the situation unless you are a certified personnel there.
Yeah.
And not only that, I guess people who have seizures, especially those who get auras, for them it's easy on them because they know that it's coming and they can find a safer place to have a seizure. I mean, I know it sounds very morbid, but at least they are aware. So if you make your coworkers aware in a classroom, kids should be aware of it.
Yeah.
Like, okay, one of their classmates is having an epilepsy disorder or a seizure and things like that.
Yeah. Well, that's something to always keep in mind. And again, it goes with epilepsy awareness. And Navita, it's been absolutely fantastic. Isn't it crazy how this conversation just takes off like that? We are going to get you back in the seat 100%. Absolutely different topics. We love talking with you on this. But before we go, let's talk real quick about the importance of early diagnosis and regular monitoring. If you're a patient or if there's someone who suspects that they or a family member has epilepsy, what is the importance of catching it early? And then how do you catch it early?
I guess more and more education towards the subject. Like when I said earlier, a kid sitting in a classroom staring and labeling them as a daydreamer, it's not that.
Right. There has to be awareness around absent seizures,
correct,
which it could possibly
yes.
be that.
And any minor signs, if you see that your loved one, they are losing track of time, they are not present in the moment, the behavioral changes, sleeping a lot or not sleeping at all, and any deviation from everyday life, I guess, I'm not saying it's going to be a seizure, but yes.
It should be looked at.
It should be looked at.
And how do we look at that?
So if someone is, the biggest thing with if somebody's having multiple seizures and they are not controlled, mood change, behavioral changes, cognition. The decline in cognition is another thing, especially seen in kids, right? Your sleep patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that should be taken into account for and seek medical help.
Right.
Don't just ignore those signs.
So for patients who suspect that they have epilepsy or their loved one has epilepsy, what should they do? You said seek medical help, go to a physician, explain what they're doing, and then what happens after that?
So there are array of tests that they would do to confirm. The very first test that is ordered is EEG. A negative EEG doesn't mean that patient is not seizing or not having seizures, right?
Why not?
Because when they come to the lab, maybe they are perfectly fine,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Brain behaves mysteriously.
And someone who has epilepsy, their brain can look just like
correct.
Someone who
there
doesn't
may
have
not be any anatomical abnormalities. If you look at the imaging study of a person who has, I'm not saying never ever, but yes, some people with seizures, their brain it looks as normal as any healthy brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then we call the idiopathic reason behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And
how long does that EEG go?
So when they come for EEG, like I said, EEG can be normal, but in the EEG lab, we provoke brain to misbehave, basically,
yeah.
Right? So we do some activation procedures, like asking the patient to breathe above the normal limit. The usual breath is like 12 breaths a minute. We ask the patient to breathe 20 or more.
So what are you looking for whenever you do these activations?
So we are basically irritating the neuronal tissues, right? So hyperventilation or breathing above the normal limit, it changes the chemistry of the brain. And if the neurons are already irritated, they kind of show up.
Mm.
So we see some abnormal pattern in their EEG. It may not be a full-on seizure, but if we are seeing something like spike and wave, or just spikes and sharps. So that is an indicator that the patient has had a seizure earlier. And
it raises the possibility.
Correct.
That this
so
patient
it
could...
kind of, and yes, it does raise the possibility. Like if someone falls down or unconscious and you bring them to the emergency room and you put electrodes on them, you would see like the brain is lighting up. There are so many sharps and spikes going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
That could be a first onset seizure for that person. And other tests we do is shine very bright lights on their face. And those lights have the frequencies. So as the test goes, it gets faster and faster. Again, irritating the cortex, irritating the brain to get any abnormality out of it.
Yeah. And then I'm assuming that the patient hopefully will then find the area of the brain. Best case scenario, is controlled by medications. If not, unfortunately, it has to go through
correct.
The process of trying to eliminate it through what we just talked about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Navita, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Like I said, we are going to have you on again. So get ready and come up with some topics because we're going to talk about this again. So thank you so much.
Thank
I
you.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Gil.
And you
thank
have
you.
A great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
All right.